Just one thing before we do jump into today's show, and that is my Beyond the Game newsletter. Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides something to stoke your curiosity before the sporting weekend? Hundreds of parents, coaches, and community sport leaders subscribe to my free newsletter called Beyond the Game. Basically, it includes a short insight from me that I've been pondering during the week, a key finding from the latest research I've been reading, as well as a cool idea from one of the inspiring minds who come on this podcast. It's all designed to help you support your athletes to be the very best that they can be. So if that sounds fun, again, it's very short, just a little goodness before you dive into your busy weekend of sport. If you'd like to try it out, just head over to athletedevelopmentproject.com/newsletter. Type in your email and you'll get the very next one. Cool. Thanks for listening. Kia ora and welcome to the Athlete Development Show podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Harrison, sports scientist, coach, and researcher focused on the developing athlete. On the show today, I'm speaking with Dane Baker. Dane is a performance dietitian who has worked extensively with New Zealand's elite athletes and organisations over the past 15 years. This includes the Chiefs and Blues rugby franchises, the Black Ferns Sevens, New Zealand Hockey, and New Zealand Swimming. Dane was the New Zealand team dietitian for the Rio Olympic Games and Gold Coast Commonwealth Games. He has a leadership role as part of Whisper, which is a specialist group dedicated to optimising female health and performance at High Performance Sport New Zealand. He's also an active researcher in the field of Red S and lecturer at the University of Otago. When he's not in the Access Sports Medicine Clinic, Dane is educating New Zealand's elite coaches as the lead nutrition provider for the High Performance Sport New Zealand Core Knowledge Coach Education Program. In addition to sport, Dane specializes in working with patients suffering from Red S, fertility issues, osteoarthritis, and diabetes. We cover lots of really cool information in this episode, from when Dane first fell in love with nutrition, through to his studies at the University of Otago in Dunedin, through working overseas at Aspetar in Qatar, his experience with the Chiefs rugby franchise, and more recently working at Access Sports Medicine in clinic setting with young athletes who are working through some struggles with low energy availability and how this really shows up in their sport. We start the conversation discussing Dane's formative years growing up playing golf in West Auckland. Enjoy.
So I was a golfer through school, so sort of like a competitive golfer, and didn't really try much at school academically, was playing golf, and then got the opportunity to go to the Otago Institute of Sport, and then we actually had Katrina Dowry, who was lecturing on nutrition.
Oh, yeah.
And so something just kind of clicked. I was just really kind of passionate around that area.
Was that an area that you, as an individual, needed to work on?
Nah. It was, I think back, because my mum used to like play around when I was, like, she would help me, like, caddy for me at golf, was really into it, and would always be trying different drinks and Gatorade and these kind of things. And maybe that just put something in my head. And then the idea of improving performance through nutrition. And then the Sports Institute was only 2 years. It was a two-year diploma. And I really wanted to stay in Dunedin and hang out with my mates. And so nutrition was a bit of a pathway. So crossing over to university. And yeah, that was quite challenging because that was a real... You have to do health science and...
Yeah, right.
Have to do chemistry and I'd never...
What did you need to get into the Polytech first?
Nothing.
Or the Institute?
Yeah,
nothing.
I just got accepted mid-year. So that... throughout my exam prep because I already had a pathway for education, so didn't go too well on my bursary. And then so then 2 years later I had to do the bridging course for you do chemistry first year at university, and I'd never done really.
How did
science.
That go?
That was pretty brutal. It was a learning experience. I passed biology, but I didn't have enough time to study for chemistry to really nail it, so I did it again the second semester. And I reckon I've never studied harder in my life, and I got like 52%. That was probably my biggest.
It's a great example of what you can do when you can see the other side.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Just like lab after lab of like and tutoring there was an old tutor there that helped me, and yeah, she originally told me with my background that I shouldn't do this paper, like there's no way I can pass. So I just said, well, I'm going to give it a go. And went opening the envelope and I got 52%.
Wow.
and that Christmas. Paved the way to become, do nutrition. And then eventually my grades got higher and higher as I studied things that I was really passionate about.
So did you get better at the skills of studying and acquiring information along that journey?
Yeah, yep. When I look back, when I was studying, it was pretty much non-existent through high school. It was maybe half an hour here and there and probably 4 hours on the golf course after school.
Yeah, right.
So that was where I spent most of my time.
Just a desire to get out of the class and not...
Yeah, it probably could have been ADHD. Both my kids are being diagnosed, so there's probably a genetic link. But I haven't been diagnosed, but... there's pretty strong suggestion that that's what maybe caused it.
It's interesting though, Ale, and it takes me back to thinking about traditional education, because clearly that's not a barrier for you in the work that you do today.
Yeah. Like it is from going from, minimal sort of effort in education when I started. I had a few people at Institute of Sport, so Byron Thomas, I don't know if you come across Byron, he was a lecturer.
I've had a little bit to do with Byron.
Yeah, Machu was a... I've forgotten his last name.
Well, where is he now?
He lives out these ways. He lives out in West Auckland. And Glenn Kearney.
Yeah.
So Glenn Kearney was a lecturer.
He's back at HP Sport now, isn't he?
Get to work with him. But just having people like that you kind of look at them, you're like, inspire you to kind of around education. But I don't think I had that when I was sort of in my high school years.
Yeah, so those mentors are so important. That age of high performance sport, we talked about this a little bit before pressing record, is that changed for you? Like those types of people that you grew up surrounded by, like are they still there? Or is it, because it's interesting to me of how certain stages of our development have either a bigger or a lesser effect on our development.
I guess so. Like a big mentor for me was my golf coach, was just the coach at the local course, and just kind of took me under his wing. And I guess I wonder now, with there's so many different sports and there's so many other distractions for kids, if you just wouldn't do that for every day after school from like 14 years of age. So having those people that give up their time, and maybe there's just less to do, there's more to focus on with sport.
What was it about your golf coach that drew you in?
And I think like golf's just like everyone kind of gets addicted to golf pretty quick and you start progressing and
it's a love-hate relationship, isn't it?
Yeah, and it was like, it was a 10-minute walk from school, so I think my mum loved it because I could just spend, all afternoon at the golf club, and then there was playing with adults too, so you get better pretty quick and you're playing with men and they kind of take you under their wing for right or wrong reasons and you learn a few different tricks but no, it was good. It was like...
Where did you grow up?
I went to Linfield College, so it was West Auckland and Mangakiki Golf Course. So you kind of just 10-minute walk from school and leave your clubs there. And so it's a pretty good way to kind of grow up. And
That's all. My cousins actually grew up going to that school. They would have been a similar age, actually, the Councils.
We've had a few people. Tyler Nathan Wong, so I've worked with her in seven. She was Linfield College, Beatrice Farm Wiener. So
it was a good age for the school.
Awesome.
And that accessibility to the environments plays a really important role. I think, arguably that's not as present in the environments of our kids these days, or at least it's not prioritized. You kind of have to go somewhere.
And there was no pressure. There was never any pressure. Like, and there'd be like three or four mates up there that we would all practice together, and you just wanted to be there, and you knew that you just wanted to get better. And there was no structured coaching. We just hit balls by us. We might have one lesson a week and the rest of the time you're just playing holes. And
what was the reason, either remembering back or thinking about it now, what was the driving force behind showing up?
I don't know. I remember I had one moment where I was not enjoying, I was playing a few bad rounds and then I was just going to quit, and then mum just kind of forced me to go one weekend. She still talks about it. And then I was like, and then I kind of then it just kind of took off after that. And then
was that early on?
Yeah, I was about 14, 15.
Were you still?
And I think I hadn't been for a few weeks, and I was kind of, you get pretty rusty pretty quick. And I was like, oh, maybe just move on to another sport. And then she's like, she could see, I think, the passion I had for it. And so just got me back up there. And
was it a bit of a plateau in your development at that point?
Potentially, yeah. Like, I always look back, like, I think my biggest weakness was, like, sports psychology. I think if right. I had have nailed that, like, playing big tournaments and just, yeah, I just used to get pretty nervous. And in golf, that's not a good place to be.
Right. So it's interesting. Was that a point in your development where the performance environments were showing up more?
Yeah. Right. It was getting pretty heavy. Like, it was just, like, for me, like, maybe I'm just drawn to those sports like I like surfing and golf, where I'm just kind of do your own thing and you kind of don't have anyone yelling at you what to do. And then when it got really competitive, like, I enjoyed it, but I wasn't loving it. But you kind of part and parcel, the better you get, you kind of have to go to these tournaments. And then and then by that time I'd gone to university, and probably going to Otago University is not the best place to really focus on being a good golfer. You learn other things and other ways of living and having a social life. And but it opened doors to university, which is pretty key.
I mean, tell me about your experience in Dunners. I mean, that's something that I share. I was there for 6 years.
Yep.
What was it about that place that, I mean, it holds a really special place in my heart.
Yep.
So share a few stories from Dunedin.
Yeah, so I didn't go to a hostel, which was probably a little bit of regret, but you could go and kind of stay in flats with guys and girls from your course, so they could set you up. So we had a flat, which to this day these guys are still like best mates. They live in Australia now. And
where was the flat?
So we're in Maitland Street, like South Dunedin.
Right.
And we had a flat out the back that were like a group of guys, and so we were 18 and couldn't cook or just couldn't look after ourselves. They were just living,
living the dream.
Living the dream, mongrels. We thought we were living like kings. We didn't realise we weren't in the student area. And then the next year we moved into the student area. So we didn't have the huge kind of, when you're in a halls, like, connection. And then second year, a lot of everyone kind of went their different ways. So that was then starting at university, kind of, and still having a few connections. But we would go to class in the morning, and then we would I just practiced golf in the afternoon at Tauri Golf Course. So that was pretty cool. And then moved to Balmac the last couple of years, was a bit closer to town. But we had Carl Heyman was one of the, he was a year ahead of us. He was the big name that went through the course. And I think there's been heaps of international reps since then.
Yeah. Lots of, definitely from a rugby point of view, they were the superstars in the lecture theatre. You were close to, and they would. Then you'd go to the Carisbrook on the weekend and watch them play. And rugby was
a big thing. So that was cool. So I got to know a lot of the guys through the course and their mates, and see that sort of close up. And and then I just ended up being more interested in sort of nutrition and studying than.
When did the golf journey come to an end?
Probably third year. Like, I didn't have a car. Like, my car broke down. I was studying more, and I was like, I was just focusing more on studying, basically, especially doing health science. That was a full-time job, just keeping my head above water first year.
Did you have, future goals within the industry at that point, or was
I was thinking about we had Ian Hallimans was one of the lecturers, and she'd been to the Olympics, and she'd always said that was like her career highlight. So back in my mind, I was like, always be cool to go to the Olympics, but it's not an opportunity that you can bank on going. But then I got selected as a team dietitian in 2016, so that was quite cool. It's kind of like a full circle moment of
awesome.
That was like a goal, and marched in the Olympics, even though I'm not an athlete, like, they needed more numbers, so I got to march, and then ended up being on TV, and so my mates had a bit of a laugh. But just seeing that was like far out. That was pretty inspiring to see what goes on at the Olympics, and just to be behind the scenes was pretty special.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't been, plenty of people that have, but bit of a special place, eh? And you can see the pull. And for you, was sport always, entrenched in your nutritional journey? Was that something?
It was all I thought about. So I was just studying nutrition with performance and sport, like, front of mind.
Right.
I started working in diabetes, which was awesome. It was like a great learning curve, like, to start seeing patients every day, patients that are referred that aren't motivated, trying to create change.
So post degree, this yep. is you ended up in a yep. was it a clinic setting?
Yep, yep. So Waitakere Hospital, so not far from here, like 3 days a week, like seeing 8 hours of like type 2 diabetics
right.
trying to improve their diet, health, lifestyle, and but at that time you're also learning a lot around carbohydrate metabolism. You're starting to learn around how to put a plan together for someone, how to consult them, how to do like a nutritional sort of history, and so you're really kind of learning a lot, really, even though it's hard, like, and it's a grind, you're learning a lot at the same time.
Yeah, super so. Interesting. So that carbohydrate metabolism, because there's elements of that in the work that you do now,
yep.
From my understanding around.
Yeah, and it's probably just like, I was lucky because I did dietetics, and you learn a lot around, consulting and a lot of work around that, where sometimes now in nutrition degrees, you're taught around the science, but not how you go around educating and putting a diet in place for someone.
So when you talk about the importance of the skills that underpin consulting, what would be an example of that?
Also, like in diabetes, this was 10, going back a little bit now, but you like they'll be on insulin. There's a certain level of sort of carbohydrate counting they need to do. So you're actually like breaking down carbohydrates per food, per meal. Like you just have a really intrinsic understanding of like how many portions of that is. You might use 10 gram or 15 gram portions of carbohydrates. That's kind of your learning curve to starting to put building blocks of a plan in place. And then now I sort of work more on energy rather than carbohydrate. But for
right.
those patients, you are kind of managing carbohydrate intakes.
And how heavily is the success dependent on the habits that underpin what they put in their mouth?
Yeah.
It's
hard. Yeah. It's like, man, we saw some sites like you would have, like we would work with mental health facilities. So you'd have people medicated, like security guards, like we'd have people like they're in jail that would come because they were diabetic, and so it was real rather than in proper practice. We kind of see like a bit of a false world of people come, they're going to pay money, they're motivated.
Yeah, right.
So I always tell like students, it's really good to cut your teeth on working with people that you need, that really need it. But
are they motivated to make the change?
Not necessarily, no. So they're referred through the system, through the healthcare system.
So they have to be there in
some
cases.
They don't have to be there. So we would sometimes have a whole day of DNAs not turning up.
Right.
But yeah, I would say a third of them would really want to make change, and then a third aren't motivated, that you would have a good chance to get them motivated. So diabetes is pretty brutal. So you could have a patient that losing a leg, going blind, they come back, they've lost a leg, but they've still got these habits in place. So, but a lot of that is our environment. It's pretty, we're in an obesogenic environment, so it's having that awareness and the cultural understanding of, where they're coming from, and that all comes, I think, from like showing empathy, your communication. So I think that's really important,
are those skills that you learn on the job? Like, has anybody sat you down and intentionally helped you to pull those pieces together?
Yeah, so I was really lucky. So I had Jenny Pierce, who was sort of a mentor for me.
Right.
So I was just, again, I was in a lucky situation where I was doing my research in dietetics, which is like our master's program, essentially, for nutrition. And the last 6 months is a research project. So I did fluid needs in Paralympic athletes, and it was for the wheelchair rugby guys, the Wheel Blacks. So under her, and then she kind of took me under her wing, and I would locum for her in clinics, and she would sit with me and watch me consult someone. I'd see her just doing it all day as well. So, yeah, I think without that sort of experience, it would be pretty challenging. So
yeah, it's cool how you get that opportunity just to be a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
It's a really powerful way of learning, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think in the coaching space, it would be great if we could create more opportunities like that, where coaches aren't necessarily into it up to their eyeballs.
Yeah,
they can stand from the outside and look in.
Yeah. And I'm sort of conscious of that now when the students kind of approach me to come and sit in, or for about 10 years now, we've had like a internship at the Chiefs and the Blues, and have like a full-time student that just is part of the team. And yeah, I think that's where all the learning happens a lot of the time. Of you have the understanding of the science, but how do you implement that with athletes?
Yeah, that's right. And you then get the space to be able to be quite reflective around what you're seeing,
yep.
which is a really powerful learning mechanism.
Yeah, yep.
Mm. So the Chiefs journey, I mean, that was a significant part of your recent history.
Yep.
How did that come about?
Yeah, so I'd just come back from Qatar. So I was that's probably another story. Went to Qatar as a sort of new graduate, worked over there, and I just came back because at the time my partner, now my wife, was just couldn't really live in the Middle East. Like, wasn't the greatest place to live back in 2008.
The Qatar journey, let's dive into that, because it's an interesting piece. I was working in
diabetes about 3 years, and then part-time with Jenny Pierce, and then just got an email from Qatar, said, do you want to come and work at Aspetar? And I didn't know where Qatar was. I had to look it up on the map. It's sort of 2007.
Just a random email.
So it was through colleagues in Australia who...
Right.
I'd done the SDA course over there, and they said, they were looking for a male dietitian. Specifically, they had two female dietitians. Obviously, the culture over there, they needed a bit of both. So they recommended me, and at that time I was, free, ready to go, and... Yeah, so...
So why did the recommendation come? Oh, like, I'm always interested
So at that time, which still happens, SDA, Sports Dietitians Australia, do a 5-day course for aspiring sort of sports dietitians. So, and that at that time was at the AIS, like in Canberra. So you had 5 days at AIS on campus. You got big tours of everything. And every day you were just getting like lectures from like John Hawley, Louise Burke, Gary Slater. All these people were just, so you really came away from that. And Greg Cox, who's a good colleague that I do research with now, I got to know him really well, and they came to him any recommendations, and they recommended me. And then I lasted about 14 months, did a year, and then so if you do a year, then you get paid to come back and you get a bonus.
Right.
So,
I
went from and it was good money. It was really good money. Like, and there was no expenses. It was played a lot of golf, got to know a lot of Australians, and. Yeah, got to work. Yeah, some pretty cool things like Qatar. We played Australia. We almost qualified for the World Cup. They sacked the coach with a couple of games to go. So you got to know around football politics.
It's an interesting football bubble over there, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah, and Bruce Hamilton was there. So Bruce is, so he was head of medicine over there. So yeah, it was a really cool experience. So I came back, and then, Phil Healy, who was the head of performance at the Chiefs, kind of just hit me up. He's like, we need a nutritionist, dietitian. Are you keen? And yeah, so that's kind of started it pretty much.
So there's lots of people that listen to the show that will be sitting there wanting to understand what it is that shows up in you and the work that you do that gets you the tap on the shoulder. I sat with a student the other day, right? And we were just talking about the industry and how small it really is, and the importance of showing up and networking and these things that everybody knows to be true.
Yeah.
So what would people say about you at that point in your career?
I think Phil knew that I'd worked in the Middle East, and he thought I had this huge responsibility over there, but I didn't tell him that I played a lot of golf. And I think he just took a chance. We'd worked together at counties. So I worked at counties rugby academy, which was back
prior
in those,
to going over.
Yeah, prior to going overseas. So I was working diabetes, and he was the head trainer for County's sort of Mitre 10 ITM Cup back in those days, which was a pretty good comp back in those days. And I would go in at like 6 in the morning and do a couple hours work with his players. And I think he just liked what I did, and then he knew I was back and the time was right. They were in between providers. And so, again, it's probably just, and that's what I always say to people, is kind of, no one wants to work for free, but when you do get an opportunity, you just got to make sure like it's your profile or personality that's at stake. So you want to make sure go above and beyond and really do a good job. And
there's not too many options though, is there, for new grads coming out of programs? I mean, both you and I have got positions inside universities.
Yep.
And the amount of students that are coming through our programs with the dream of working in this space.
Yep.
The jobs just don't exist, do they?
No. And it's kind of getting harder, I think, because sport like rugby, there's my opinion, it's getting bigger, but then there's more other roles that are getting filled up. So I think if anything, it's getting diluted a bit from the sports science compared to what I see. And I work closely with Australians and see the level of investment they have. It's
so what do you mean
staggering.
Dig into that a little bit more, like what's getting diluted,
like within a I don't know if we prioritize sports science and S&C as much as it is like in the AFL and in particular NRL. maybe it's probably just because of our economy, like the size of our teams. But, you know, we have a lot of people working within the, you know, Super Rugby franchises, half a day a week.
Right.
And it's, you know, it's hard because it's like most of us will balance multiple roles. Some people have a full-time job, but that's very far and few between. So
the chief's role is as the lead nutritionist.
Yep.
Wasn't full-time?
No. So it was 2 days a week. So I'll be 3 days a week in season and then 1 to 2 days a week in season.
So what would it look like if it was full-time? Like, is the work there or does it need to
evolve? I think the problem with New Zealand rugby is the franchises are the franchise. They're just really in business from November till July, till the season finishes. Then you've got your provincial unions where other, you know, overseas you've got under-18s right up to your main squad. So there's a lot more development work where in rugby you're kind of just working for the Super Rugby. Sometimes you might then work for Auckland Rugby and you put pieces together and have a full-time role.
Yeah, but there's no alignment in those.
No, only unless you've got a provincial union that wants to just, you know, buy into it and make sure everything lines up. But yeah, people change and, you know, different roles and then it's hard to put that together. But I think I was lucky because then I worked for high performance sport for 10 years where I'd work with swimming, hockey, then sevens. I think that I really enjoyed that, having like different sports, even though it's super busy, just gives you a lot of, I was lucky. I think I would get bored pretty quickly, and I've never done that working with just one team.
Right. Is that the nature of the work is quite repetitive inside a rugby team?
Like, you've always got what you've got your key players that you need to keep on top of that from maybe struggle from a body composition perspective that you're just spending a lot more time with. But then at the Chiefs, we did a lot of innovation. We had a lot of awesome coaches, support staff. They're always wanting to go deeper and answer questions, and we were really well supported by coaches to do research, and it was just a really awesome time for about 5 or 6 years that we were just doing a lot of work and answering a lot of questions. But we had coaches that would challenge us to get better and answer these questions.
So what were you on the edge of in terms of the science and how that was applied?
Yeah, so I guess like we started off doing, I mean, 2013 we did a study on immunity with probiotics. We were one of the first professional teams to kind of publish research on probiotics with immune system immunity. So we found that using probiotics would reduce illness by about 2 to 3 days in length. That was the year that we won. So we didn't really know what we were getting into, that doing an immunity study where you're doing daily symptom checks over 8 weeks. The players weren't too happy about that after that. And then we did a bit of hydration work, understanding our hydration requirements. And then we really got into the work of energy availability. So this is going back like 2013, 14, where we had a lot of players we were seeing that we were really struggling to put muscle on during preseason. A lot of players, we were seeing a body image concerns, a lot of them wanting to get leaner and leaner, but the coach wanted them to be bigger and stronger. So that really made us dive into we did a really big sort of pre-season study where we basically weighed and filmed everything the guys ate for 3 to 5 days. We analysed everything they were doing movement-wise. We had like sports scientists, like Brett Smith, who was a big part of our team. He would do all the GPS data and we would do surveys. And from that, we learnt so much around what we needed to fuel the guys with. And that helped. We got funding from the board to spend, you know, huge amounts of money on nutrition to feed these guys. The coaches really bought into it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So there's elements of that, the work that you do now, that at least from a science point of view. So that idea of energy expenditure, like how much are these guys actually?
And that's what really got us interested, because obviously where Dave Rennie was and Wayne Smith and Andrew Strawbridge, Tom Coventry, like they wanted to train the guys, and we were like, if you look back at those teams, we were super fit, but it was coming at a cost of like, we couldn't have a young lock for a preseason and get him to gain 3 or 4 kilos. It was just really hard. So really learning what they're expending, and then we could use that language to the players to actually, during that time as well, there was a lot of, you know, paleo diet, low carb diet, a lot of the guys were confused. So we just brought it back to energy, and that they really bought into that, and it was
so good. And at the time they were responsible for the large majority of what they were eating?
So that basically created our whole sort of recovery strategies and nutritional, what we would provide to the players. So we then basically stage their recovery with. We had like three or four different groups of how much energy guys needed. We call them like super gainers. That would be like their recovery might be like 1,000 calories type recovery beverages, things like that. So we had guys up eating up to 7,000-8,000 calories a day.
That's a lot of food.
Yeah. And so these guys, like 115 kilo guys, like super lean, just doing 3 to 4 hours of training a day, just burning a huge amount of energy.
And do these individuals respond differently to the same amount of training, for example? Like, is their expenditure different, you and I, over 3 hours?
Yeah, because of the size. So, right. You know, most of the nutritional researchers, especially like energy requirements off, and back in those days was done a lot of endurance athletes, you know, 65, 75 kilo middle distance runner, where we've got 115 kilo like lock. That's just...
And is that based off the lean body mass?
Yep, lean body mass, yeah. and the work that they were doing. And so like so much of rugby now is just all about high intensity, repeated effort, working at high speed, and that like acceleration, deacceleration, like that comes at a metabolic cost that's...
Right.
Pretty significant.
So if you've got a lock versus a halfback.
Yep. Yeah. So you're working with everyone individually.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at some point when you've got 45 players, you've kind of got to put them into the not everyone's on a, you know, a prescription plan. You've got to, so we would have recovery stations where we would have like low energy, high energy, really high energy, and try to push guys into different areas, keeping protein the same. But yeah, so that was a really, and we were just really well supported to fund that. And because to eat that much energy, you can't, they're not going to go home and, you know, make their own recovery. Like, they're doing 3 or 4 trainings a day, so we're just trying to find opportunities to feed them pretty much.
And how much of their total daily energy input is coming from an organized environment? Like, are they doing dinners on their own?
Or dinners on their own. So most of the time now, like at the Blues, we've got they've got a chef. He'll cook them a really good lunch. And so especially now, like professional environments, there's more demand on the players. There's meetings, there's analysis. You know, they're there for, you know, 8-9 hours a day. So that can be built into the schedule to have time to go and get something to eat. But yeah, so a lot more is... Some clubs, though, will be like self-driven. So it just depends on the club, basically, and
right.
funding, which, yeah, food costs a lot of money.
Mm. So, I mean, and it sounds to me like it's a great foundation to then, you know, move into the work that you're doing now. And obviously,
yep.
we're interested in the adolescent athlete on
yep.
on this podcast. But you work with a lot of
yep.
teenage kids, don't you?
Yeah. So, and, yeah.
Yeah, so I'd love to understand, you know, what you really are interested in these days and
yep.
and what you spend your time doing and see if we can... You know, help people to understand some
yeah.
of these issues around energy
yeah.
availability.
So I guess like that, diving into energy availability with the Chiefs guys for so many years, and then that progressed into the Blackburn Sevens that I worked with for like sort of 8 years, and then basically just using those systems and ways of kind of having athletes understand their energy requirements. And yeah, and that's gone on now. So I work at Axis Sports Medicine, where I work privately and see a whole range of athletes, adolescent athletes, elite athletes, people just looking to improve their health. And so, but applying those, you know, philosophies around energy availability, it's essentially just like fueling the work that you're doing, is one of the papers that's been written by guys in the UK. That's a way we kind of think about sports nutrition now, is just, you know, carbohydrate availability, fueling the work, the high intensity work that you're doing. So no one's ever just on a blanket kind of approach. And but I think the thing with the adolescent athletes is just the volume of training that they're doing. And one of the challenges that we know with sort of athletes and energy intakes is appetite isn't a good guide of energy requirements. We know from multiple times now when research is done, you increase training load, only half maybe those subjects will increase their energy intake. So that's the idea, is having a structured plan around how much energy they need, how to spread that out, making it really simple with food, but having a plan. That's basically
yeah.
what I do.
And so are you seeing kids you know, when they walk into your clinic, what are the reasons that they're there?
Yeah,
because it's an important place to start, I think, is to work with the why. So what are you seeing?
So see a range of patients and athletes, or patients and athletes, same thing, sort of thing. Probably half my work is in RED-S, which would be diagnosed So red S is relative energy deficiency in sport. Another term is sort of hypothalamic amenorrhea in female athletes, which is essentially energy deficiency that's they've been exposed to for a certain amount of time, and that's caused menstrual dysfunction. They could appear with a stress fracture that's been followed up by the sports physician. To adolescent athletes that might just turn up with really fatigue, like your classic rower in December that's fallen off a cliff and struggling. To swimmers, yeah. A lot of swimmers, young swimmers, and that's the classic, like they're building volume and not making the adjustments in their nutrition.
Have they come through a referral system? Like they're showing up their GP and the GP is making an assumption around low energy availability?
Yep. So we do a lot of work in the GP space trying to educate GPs around low energy availability. Got to know quite a lot of GPs now, and that's really important. Then word of mouth and talking to schools, and so do a lot of work at schools just trying to educate around, specifically around what low energy availability is, but not just looking at it. I've always been really interested in looking how you can optimize performance with it, rather than we know low energy availability causes, you know, a whole raft of physiological consequences. But when you can actually get that energy availability match for different days of training, how we can optimize performance, recovery, get these athletes, you know, tracking body comp wise if they need to gain lean muscle, you know. And we know from the research is the more well fueled you are, the more lean muscle, you know. So it's just I just really enjoy mapping out someone's kind of training week and putting a plan together for
them. Yeah. So let's start it. Perhaps when they do walk through your door, what is the process that you go through?
Yep.
Because I think if anything, it's a complicated problem to solve, isn't it? Like it's not necessarily just a matter of giving them the program and seeing them on their way. So how do you go about thinking of solving these problems?
Yeah. So we're just about to publish some research. We've surveyed 150 patients that have recovered from Red S. So they're just a subset of the patients we see, but one of the biggest things I've identified is that light bulb moment of understanding their energy requirements. So understanding energy availability, understanding what's happening to their body when things are down regulating from lack of a regular menstrual cycle, the fatigue, the brain fog, and then going, okay, this is what your body needs and this is how we're going to go about it. So, and that's the big part of what I do is trying to spend 20 minutes or 30 minutes in the consult talking them through that. So there's a lot of education, talk them through slides, talk them through how I'm going to put the plan together.
Do you have that information on hand? Like do you know how much kilocalories?
No, so my whole process is I spend an hour do a full consultation, and then I might spend 45 minutes to an hour sometimes putting their plan together. So we individualize it, but I'll be talking them through what I'm going to send them and using other examples, and then essentially just pretty much in a nutshell, I'm sort of planning their microcycle, like their 7-day training schedule.
Right. How is it measured?
So I use the energy availability, which if you kind of go through Anne Locks's work, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but basically in nutrition, there's most people think of energy balance, which is calories go in, calories go out, and everything stays the same. The problem with that is our bodies can adapt really easily. So you could be weight stable, but you're under fueling, if that makes sense. So what's happening underneath is your metabolic rate's down regulating, and that's coming at a cost of the body, the bone metabolism, menstrual cycle.
Yeah, some of those really important growth factors for the adolescent.
Yeah, and so sometimes people are like, my weight's stable, that can't be a problem, but that's, you like after seeing, we've seen like 1,000 patients now over the last few years, and you just see the classic. There's a lot of things you pick up pretty quick now that you...
So people have been measuring, you know, the numbers on the scale for so long.
So a lot of the referrals will come through because there's been a period of amenorrhea, which has been diagnosed. Part of the challenges with energy availability is it's really inaccurate to measure someone through diet because there's a 20-30% error in assessing someone's energy intake, 20-30% error in actually assessing how much energy they're expending. So you need a full clinical workup, pretty much.
Talk to me about that. Like, what is the process of figuring that out?
So that would be done by a medical lead, like a sports physician or a reproductive endocrinologist. And that would be your classic sort of Red S patient. And what they are looking to do is to basically, it's a diagnosis of excluding everything else. So there could be other reasons why someone's not having a regular cycle. And then it comes back to their diagnosis to say, okay, this is an energy availability issue. We need to work on the fueling. There could be a big psychological element. There could be a clinical eating disorder piece in this. And in that case, the specialist will work with an eating disorder specialist. If it's more inadvertent, which is where I deal a lot with, which would be just mismatching the energy requirements. And that's when a lot of these patients, it's often been like a 1 or 2 year process before they've been to me, where they often might present with gut issues. They might try a low FODMAP diet. They've cut out gluten. They've gone low carb. So we kind of bring it back to energy and explaining what's going on in their body and explaining, okay, we're going to need to try to eat this much. We don't get anyone counting calories, but we use examples of blocks of food that are
right.
going to contain so much energy.
So it's a matter of excluding some of these other things that are more easily determined. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, not easily. So like one of the things would be like...
So blood work, for example.
Blood work,
What shows up in blood work?
Blood work, so the hormonal, so the reproductive hormonal screen of all the different 5 or 6 different reproductive hormones that you need to be a really medical specialist to understand. They might do an MRI.
On bone mineral density, things like that.
They do a DEXA, and then they'll also, just a real thorough clinical examination as well. And so you need to have that. It could be PCOS, things like that. So that will all come up in the blood work. And there's other things they need to rule out, why someone's, cancer, things like that. So
sure.
Those are the 1 or 2 percenters, but that's why you do need that medical lead. And the great thing for me is there's been a diagnosis and there's belief now. And like, okay. Where a lot of the time in high performance sport, like 10 years ago, you had awareness of this, but you maybe didn't have the medical support to say, this is what's going on. So I'm lucky that I work with specialists that see this every day. And so when they come to me, like they're like, okay, maybe the parent and the patient, we're going to really, they buy into it. So it is a diagnosis that isn't easy. Like a lot of people sometimes don't buy into it, but it might take a year or two. We might see them again in a year that they've come around to.
And what's the obstacle in the way of believing in the diagnosis and therefore being motivated to make some change?
Yeah, it's literally a mismatch in energy.
Right.
And that's not easy. So there's a couple, like there could be a strong restricted eating pattern that's gone on in play, which is extremely prevalent in our younger, adolescents.
And getting worse.
Yeah, absolutely. Social media, it's not getting better. Yeah. Mm. And so I guess the culture around body image, what they see on social media, we're just driven to think leaner is better. And then the other part of this is just the volume of training. So getting them to understand if you're doing 2 swimming sessions a day, that might you're probably needing to eat 3,500-4,000 calories sometimes. And if they're feeling completely full at 2,000, that's when you need to be able to buy into the process. And it is a process, so it can often be 12 to 18 month recovery to restore a regular cycle. And that means sort of regular follow-ups, more blood work. So we'd rather someone not get into the situation.
Mm. And it depends on how long they've been in that state for well, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The longer they've been in a low energy state, the more dire the circumstances.
Yeah. And we don't have much research at all on recovery. So that's what we're trying to do at Axis, because we're lucky enough to see a lot of these REDS patients and try to understand what are the barriers and facilitators to change from a nutrition perspective. So that's been really good and sort of reinforcing the lengths we go to put these plans together are really working, rather than saying, I think that's what I believe is, like, if I just saw a patient say, this is what I think you need to eat, I think that causes a bit of distrust. So you're talking them through the science, and that's what the specialist really encouraged me to do, was like, take the emotion out of it, let's keep this scientific and let's see if this approach works. And it seems to have worked really well.
Right. So give us a bit of a case study example, perhaps a rower or a swimmer. You've mentioned both of those sports. So they come in, they've had the previous work done to diagnose and they're in a state of low energy availability.
Yep. So we've got quite a few case studies because we present these at conferences. So one that we present quite often was an elite female cyclist. So she was high performance sports cyclist, had gone for about 2 years with their medical team of, she's not having a regular period, why is this happening, back and forth, not really kind of believing it was low energy availability. Ends up going to the endocrinologist. This is after about 2 years of about 3 or 4 year journey of the athlete thinking, okay, I really want to address this. Increased their fueling, gained about 8 kilograms, so, but still no period. Had her first period in COVID and thought, okay, I've got this. And then another 6 months till the next one. Saw the endocrinologist, full review, said, right, I think this is clearly red S. Let's start working on the nutrition side of it. It was really good. Cycling were super supportive in this process. And yeah, we just put a plan together for her where she was probably chronically consuming about like 2,200 calories. Do go through the energy availability type scenario of what I think she needed based on her training, which was closer to like 3,200. Adjusted her recovery, adjusted the portions of her main meal just across her different training days. Yeah, and I think within 4-5 months, she had four cycles and then had a what we call an ovulatory cycle, which means the right time length in the cycle where the hormones are optimized and ovulation takes place. And that, yeah, so within 5 months, for her, it was just more awareness around, actually, I thought I was fueling.
Right.
But it just wasn't enough.
As a practitioner, are you aware of the energy requirements based on what they talk to you about?
Yeah, so there's a bit of artwork in that. And the thing that I sort of explain is I'll be working in a lot of diagnosed groups. So our goal is essentially to increase energy intake. We're not trying to get it right to the exact amount. So I will use a lot of cyclists will have their Garmin data. Runners are quite easy to calculate. You can use metabolic equivalents of how much time they're doing, try to understand that. And then you're kind of estimating, but
right,
the more you do this, you start getting a pretty good feel.
Sure.
And that's part of the consultation is, okay, what does your hockey training look like? Talk me through what you're doing, your swim session, your water polo. Are you swimming for 45 minutes at the start? And then I'll be going away and putting those through, trying to show them different days of training.
And so you create that plan, they go and start embarking on it. And
yep.
And what is the process of staying in touch with them? How do you understand whether success is
yeah, so from a Red S patient perspective, they will be coordinated by the specialist,
right,
who will organize follow-ups. I typically try to see someone again in about 12 weeks. And the idea being the body just needs a sustained period of time with enough energy. And if they want to come back early, that's fine. And then at the 12-week mark, typically we've had a couple of blood tests at 4 to 6 weeks. We can start to see if the hormone levels are increasing, how they're feeling, how the plan's going. And sometimes we just need and I'll discuss that with them initially, is we just need to keep, this is the first blueprint, and we might just...
It's a line in the sand.
I likely might be underestimating your requirements. You might be on your feet all day, every day, that we just don't know about.
Yeah.
Stress is a big part of it as well, huge part. Cortisol, stress hormone. So, and then it's trying to keep them going, really. Sometimes it can take 18 months. Sometimes it can take, like in that cyclist, it's 2 to 3 months. She's like, I'm sorted. Like, I've got this. I know what I'm doing.
What sort of impact does stress have? I mean, with that higher,
yep,
you know, circulating cortisol, greater,
yep,
catabolism that's,
yep,
happening.
Yep.
How much more food is...
Yeah.
Is,
yeah,
it about getting, like, reducing the cortisol, or is it just
a little
about
bit,
eating
so,
more?
Yeah. So there's been a bit of work done in Scandinavia where they've looked at athletes that eat the same thing every day, but they've gone back and looked at food diaries and how they distribute their energy. And so distribution is probably just as key as total intake. And one of the things that came up was the longer someone goes without eating, or the more unstructured, the greater cortisol. And so the more cortisol, that can have flow-on effects to reduction in estrogen. So, and that can come from psychological stress as well.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of it.
And that's arguably higher than it's ever been.
Yes.
In general.
Yeah.
What do you mean by unstructured?
So, like, basically, if you kind of think about a 24-hour period of time, like, if you're fasting, for example, or you're eating your first meal at lunchtime, but you've done 3 hours of training in the morning, they've got these really nice mathematical models that can show you that you're in a negative energy balance for longer in the day. And so it just, if you think of sports nutrition 101, it's around fueling during training if that's required, recovery. So all of these things, I think, that we know in sports nutrition, but with social media and, you know, fad diets, it's pretty hard to convince people sometimes that they need to eat regularly. So that's and sometimes it's just logistics. Like it's hard to feel like that when you're leaving home at 5 a.m. and you're coming home at 8 p.m.
I think that's a big thing that shows up in my conversations is just the logistical challenges of eating.
Yep.
I mean, and it starts young. Like my 9-year-old came home yesterday.
Yep.
With his sandwiches still in his lunchbox.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what's going on? This is 2 lunches in a row. I was the wet monitor in class. I didn't have a chance to eat.
Yeah.
I mean, not a good excuse.
No.
but this is where it starts. Isn't it? All of a sudden.
And I guess the more as they grow and then they really get into that like 13 to 16 years where the skeleton's really laying down some tissue, that's the time if they've got a high expenditure that things can go a little bit wrong, and that's what we typically start seeing. But yeah, just, and that's why the part of the plan is working with the foods they're eating and trying to find simple strategies really. That's it.
What do you know about performance and how nutrition can optimize that over time, particularly during the adolescent growth spurt?
Yeah.
Because this is super interesting to me. If we could get to the point where we were fueling appropriately and training smartly, like what have we got that we know when, like the ceiling
has to be
higher.
If you think back, like I'm lucky enough I work with Brett Smith, sports scientist, and Craig Palmer of our core knowledge group where we educate coaches. And I think the biggest thing that comes out of this, if we can just get adolescents training consistently, not succumbing to illness, not succumbing to injury, there's obviously a lot of factors of injury, but I think nutrition is a massive part of that, like restoring energy, restoring glycogen, just getting them to train really well. And that's where I think people misunderstand is like when I'm talking them through, like, what are you trying to do if you're training? You're trying to sort of, each time you're training, getting the most out of your session rather than just surviving it. Everyone can go to training, but what are you actually getting out of it? And that's where I think nutrition, if you get that right, you get the timing right, you get, do they need fuel during some of these 2-hour sessions, recovery, restoring that energy if they're training again the next morning, all of these things around training quality.
It's interesting. These things for me all come together. Like we know that the adolescent athlete, particularly team sport athletes, spend a lot of time in the gray zone, you know, between 75 and 85 to 90% of heart rate max
as
an arbitrary zone, right? We're highly metabolically demanding.
Yep. Glycolytic.
But not necessarily giving them the return on investment
from
a performance point of view.
Yep.
And so where are you at with having conversations with the coach, for example, to train smarter?
It's a hard thing. It's a missing piece with us privately is that we don't have access to the coach. I do work with some really good coaches. So I see a lot of James Morton, the
sprint
coach.
He was on the show not that long ago.
So he's a guy that just said, I want you to see my sprinters, and I just every letter I just he's copied in on what we were doing. Just keeps he's super chill. The athletes love him, and just that's a really good example of just.
Yeah, and so from your point of view, is there a recommendation to reduce energy expenditure, for example?
No. So, I mean, my job essentially, like, I think is to fuel what they're doing.
Right.
That's what I try and do. But
What if you get to a point where the athlete is just struggling big
time to
eat enough?
Not in James's athlete situation, but like in the adolescent athletes I see. Like, let's say I see a classic. There's a couple of sports that often come to mind as the rower, or it's the it's the water polo player or the swimmer that's doing hockey as well. And I'll go through every patient their whole training week and like have a table Monday to Sunday, different times of training. And where are the days you're getting tired? Thursday morning, I'm knackered. And it's like, okay, so you're doing your swim program. The coach has given you Wednesday off training. And then you've filled that right up with 2 hockey trainings. And it's like, there's no rest day. And the rest days are filled up with classic high intensity running. And it's like, first thing I'll say is like, do you have a good relationship with your coach? Talk to your coach, because there'll be a reason why you are feeling fatigued, and understand your training program rather than just like whinging to me about you're tired. Like, figure out why maybe you should be tired and how tired is a good thing.
Right, yeah.
But then as well, like I'll try to write in the letters to encourage them to have that conversation. And that's the part that I think we get stuck with is there's 3 different sports going on and no one's talking to each other. The good coaches will. Like, they'll have an understanding of what the other teams are doing, but some don't. And that's when you just see, like, it's pretty normal now to see 20, 25 hour a week for a 13 to 15 year old.
Is that solution even achievable from a sport talking to another sport point of view. I can't even really resolve that in my head.
The only thing we've seen in our core knowledge, which looked really good, there's a few schools now with their sort of head of sport that if there's a really, you know, an athlete in the senior ranks, I guess, doing multiple sports, they have a sit down every semester around what their program looks like and seeing how their trainings are across the week and having those discussions. But that doesn't seem to be happening across in many schools.
Yeah, I mean, that's a challenging thing to do for schools, to be able to resource that from a time and also from a knowledge point of view. That head of sport needs to understand some core principles around, you know,
and
what you're
talking about.
It's not saying
you don't want to do multiple sports, but if you're a middle distance runner that's then doing a key track session and then at 7:30 at night you're doing 2 hours of hockey, it doesn't seem like it's a great idea.
Unachievable.
Yeah.
You know, there's only one way that that's going to turn out, I think.
Yeah.
And so this is where the tension lies, I think, is we're recommending that they play multiple sports, yet every sport is demanding more and more time.
Yeah.
And so do you think there is a case for doing less sport in some of these cases?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of athletes would benefit from a performance perspective of just recovering and having a bit more of a periodized approach to their training. At the same time, you want kids to, you know, participate and do what. But I think at that pointy end level of performance, when you've got someone training for, you know, 5 to 10 hours a week in your sport, then it multiple sports, especially like endurance based, or that's when it becomes challenging. And more of these sports now, there's more academies. We've got kids now at lunchtime doing specialized training, so the day gets pretty chocker pretty quick.
Yeah, and so the kids that you're seeing tend to be the high achievers, air quotes, the ones that are doing well at that level of development. You know, they're in the top teams or they're in the special program or
we see a range. It could be like young athlete that just like just doing an obscure sport that's just feeling tired, and her mum's just like, I need you to tell him to eat more because he won't listen to me.
Right.
And so that's always fun. I think most people come to see me thinking, oh, he's going to tell me to eat less, and they're pretty shocked when I tell them you need to be eating kind of double what you're eating.
Yeah.
And they come away feeling, oh, wow, they're pretty happy. But yeah, and it could be the high achievers, particularly in our low energy availability patients, is pretty prevalent. So it's been quite a bit of work done in the US around this, I forget a name, but Boston researcher, which looked at the personality type and that A-type personality, high achiever. And so there's not only the training, but there's also the extracurricular activities. You know, there are often meetings all through school, after school.
So cognitively, they're exhausted as well, aren't they?
I'd say, yeah, yep.
And that, I mean, that's going to affect all of those stress hormones and all of a sudden they're consuming.
It is amazing to see how much they achieve with what they're doing. Like, I'm just still blown away. Think back to myself at school, like they're training this much and their grades sound amazing, and it's just like
is it sustainable?
Yeah,
you know, like that's the question,
that's the
though, isn't it?
Like, yep, and that's a challenge with Red S's. Like, it's pretty catastrophic to have a stress fracture or go through this process at adolescence. So we'd far rather not have the ambulance at the bottom of the cliff. But we have seen some really good success stories recovering and really succeeding on the elite level, but it's a long process.
So let's talk about fad diets, because this does come up a lot. And I'm interested in, you know, what these diets actually mean. So for example, the plant-based diet, all of a sudden protein is dropping, or it's much harder to access based on the foods that they're eating. And so could you talk us through a few of these things that you're seeing now and the consequences of those from a macronutrient point of view?
Yep. So one of the ones you just mentioned then, the plant-based diet in particular, especially now with Netflix is the classic one. You know, the latest one has been Game Changers, which overnight we had about 12 Blues players become plant-based. Probably
amazing the power.
Two
of
them lasted longer than 7 days, and then the other two hung in there. But there's a lot of good information in that. But with all of those, they're telling, they've got 90 minutes. James Cameron directed it. He's a pretty good storyteller, so it's pretty convincing. There's a lot of stuff that's accurate. A lot of it's not. It's hard to decipher what's right. And
Well, not accurate for the individual who's playing high-level rugby either, right?
Exactly. So one of the things from an energy availability perspective is overnight you might have an athlete that's cut out a whole food group. And most of the time, they haven't grown up in a vegetarian family that's really good at balancing protein, understanding how to cook, being planned, and they will get into a state of low energy pretty quickly. We have a lot of athletes that succeed on a plant-based diet. It can be a really powerful diet, because one of the good things of plant-based diet is you'll start getting pretty good carbohydrate intakes, having a lot of vegetables, a lot of nutrients, a lot of really good stuff in your diet. It's just when you start completely taking your food group out, and there can be reasons at the elite level where you might periodize carbohydrate intake, but at an adolescent level, that's, we don't really want to, that approach is going to start compromising health pretty quickly.
From a science point of view, can you access the right types of proteins on a without animal protein?
Yep.
Without supplementing?
Of course you can. It just becomes, you just need more and more planned. And that's not something many athletes are.
So what are the types? there's certain essential amino acids that you need. What do you need to be eating if all of a sudden meat
It depends on the level of restriction, I guess. So I think that's the first question you should have with your athletes, is what does plant-based look like for you? For a lot of athletes now, we talk about like the more terminology, like a plant-forward diet, which might be something as simply as 1 or 2 days a week I'm trying to reduce my meat intake for environmental reasons. And to complete like no dairy, no meat, no animal proteins. And in that situation, without milk, cheese, dairy products, fish, it's a lot harder to put those pieces together. And one of the challenges is if you take all those foods out, you're going to be relying on a lot of pulses, legumes to get your protein intake. And so with that, you start getting a lot of fiber in your diet. For most people that are overweight, obese, that's going to be a good thing. They're going to start losing weight and become a lot healthier. For our active athletes, they're going to start to, if they're not well planned, they're going to start dipping into that low energy state pretty quickly.
What is it about fiber? Is that a lack of appetite?
It's filling.
Right.
Yep. And that's the challenging part in this, is we've got 90% of the population that are probably overeating, and it's that 10% that we deal with that are active, that we know from for 30, 40 years that athletes can compete really well for plant-based diet and succeed. So it's not like it can't be done, but those athletes will... I think the more planned you are, and sometimes that's a conversation in itself, is why are you doing this? Like, is it for performance? Talk me through why it's for performance. If I've just watched Game Changers, then maybe there's a bit of conversation around, well, let's go deeper into the science. I think there's a big push for environmental, which I think is pretty accurate. So it's definitely something that I spend a lot of my time putting plant-based plans together for athletes, but a lot of it's around educating how you replace things. So a classic thing might be, if we've taken meat out of the diet, that's going to be 180 grams of meat. To replace that with protein and energy is about like 1.5 cups of beans. Most people won't do that. They'll have a scattering of beans. It's mainly vegetables.
it's a lot of beans. When I was playing around with proteins, and all of a sudden you need to put that much beans on your plate.
Yep.
It's a lot of beans.
But if you can include a bit of cheese, you include egg, things become pretty a lot easier, a lot more manageable. And there's a lot of like food technology is catching up. So there's a lot of research now with protein blends, where say like a certain type of plant-based protein might be lacking the amino acid. Now they can formulate like food products that have a blend. And as long as the protein's adequate, like it matches the protein amount, we're seeing the same response physiologically. So we're in the past it was comparing whey protein to soy protein, where it's not really a fair comparison, but now you can match things. And
right, yeah. So that's cool. Yeah. I want to come back to maybe one or two more fair diets, but as an aside, where are we at with protein recommendations for athletes? And I realize it differs based on the sport they're doing.
Yep.
But is there a rule of thumb for the amount of protein? Because I'm trying to keep up with the research, but it seems to fluctuate.
Probably the biggest message for protein would be most athletes, young athletes, that have a pretty good attitude to nutrition. They eat meat and all sorts of protein. They're probably going to get enough protein in their diet. It's how they distribute that protein. So that's what we're often working as a dietitian with them around.
So you don't necessarily look at X amount of kgs per...
No. So it's kind of like at a per meal or per snack kind of basis. where if you kind of look at sort of the physiology of how our muscle is balanced is through protein breakdown, and then we'll consume, let's say maybe we consume 20 to 30 grams of protein, we get this process called like protein synthesis, which is protein getting absorbed into the lean tissue. And that can happen maybe 4 to 5 times per day if we get the dose right. So if you have all of your protein at the end of the night, let's say you have like half a cow for dinner, you have 200 grams of meat, you'll get protein synthesis, but you can only absorb so much.
Right. So there's a waste of that use.
But it doesn't mean that you only need to eat that 120 grams because some of that energy will be used for other processes. But from a health or body comp perspective, we'd rather spread that out. So one of the biggest meals is often the breakfast meal. Can be pretty low in protein. It could be jam on toast. A lot of younger athletes, it's making sure they have enough protein with their lunch. Just making sure they have the awareness of what a protein food looks like. If they're having a sandwich, can they get a bit of protein? Could be like an animal protein, a bit of cheese, things like that.
So is there a gram amount that you recommend for each meal?
Yeah, so like it's just probably at the moment, it's probably somewhere between 20 to 30 grams. It's a bit of a rough, for your adolescent athlete, probably 20 grams would be enough. You can get a little bit more in depth. It's around sort of 0.3 grams per kilo per meal, per snack, which for your bigger athletes, like your big 120 kilo prop, it's probably about 30 to 40 grams of protein, just because they've got more muscle mass. And that's what's interesting. So when you've got like your 50 kilo gymnast, like a glass of milk, they're going to get the protein that they need from that. So it's just having, and they're not going to be able to tolerate a full dose of protein as well. So, especially at a younger age.
And so when they're adding more trainings into their schedule, are you recommending like another dose of protein? Is that
well,
how
it could be,
up?
Yeah. So like it's probably just making sure how their day is matched. And because they're going to be eating more frequently, they're going to naturally start to increase their intake of protein. And so you just want to make sure that it's not all protein and not carbohydrate, probably. And that sometimes that can happen if there's a big reliance on protein powder. In my work, a lot of the time I'm dealing with athletes under fueling, so I'm not going to take, like, if they're having protein, but I don't want to take it out of their diet, but just want to make sure that they're distributing it probably in a beneficial way and not thinking that just I'm having my protein shake after my 3-hour ride on the bike with water, it's going to be sufficient in energy. Those are the kind of things we're kind of looking at, and how could we make that shake have more carbohydrate, more balanced fat, more nutrients in there. Or they're having that and they're going into a meal, just how they're putting their day together. That's kind of, there's no right or wrong approach. It's just trying to get enough nutrients in the day is key. But I think like from a total amount, we're pretty convinced about like 1.6 grams per kilo for an athlete. Above that probably doesn't make much difference. So, and again, we don't have protein recommendations for young or adolescent athletes. We probably think from the literature at the moment that following the adult recommendations and just distributing protein well is sufficient.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if you were doing research in that area, how you adjust for growth.
Yep.
That doesn't show up in adult.
And it's really hard. Like you can't do any of this. There's almost no research done in this younger age group other than looking at like data over like food surveys, New Zealand Health Survey, of even that data's pretty weak. So you can use growth charts, but pretty much you like people, like the athletes we see working on an individual level. If you're concerned with impaired growth, then you're probably looking at more of a pediatric dietitian that's going to look through those things. And we work closely with a few of those as well.
Mm. So you spoke about carbohydrates and lack thereof. Like is that just around not planning the day well? Is it around fad diets that are showing up that are recommending against
carbohydrates? It's fad diets. So I think one of the real interesting pieces at the moment is the research around carbohydrate intake and bone metabolism. There's a lot of work going on in Australia around showing carbohydrate intake, and if it's absent for prolonged hard sessions, there's actually a down regulation in bone metabolism, which is really interesting. It's been done about 3 or 4 times now. We also know from sort of Anne Locks's work, when she was looking at energy availability, those on a lower carbohydrate intake had more reproductive down regulation.
Sure.
So, and going on to what a lot of Stacey Sims will talk about, is a lot of these studies haven't been done in females, and the female physiology, especially like if fasting, low carbohydrates, it's.
Yeah, she's pretty staunch about that, isn't she? She's not a fan of.
No, and that's where the whole energy distribution is so important, is pre-training, post-training, if that session's long enough, what does that fuel look like? And I think that's where the real fear of sugar, and probably rightly so, like, you know, most people buy a Powerade in the petrol station, but there are, you know, 5% of athletes that need additional carbohydrate for some of these 2-hour pool sessions or...
Yeah, what's going on hormonally when those carbohydrates are down?
Yep, so we see like an increase in cortisol,
right?
We can see, and that can affect, yeah. So it can affect, especially if we're looking at a reproductive picture, trying to optimize that, we want a balance. And it really, it's more around energy distribution as well, making sure if we go longer in a fasted state, then we've got more of that stress hormone, which then kind of takes over a little bit.
Yeah.
So just balances. And again, it's, there's no right or wrong of how much everyone needs. It's trying to understand what their training looks like and then how much carbohydrate. And that's the challenging thing, because a big piece of this is the parents. So the parents could be on their own journey where they actually might benefit from a low carbohydrate diet. They might be doing 30 minutes a day.
Yeah, it's
their requirements are
it?
Maybe 10% of what their, you know, athlete training 25 hours a week looks like. So those are the conversations when I do presentations, try to sort of emphasize
that it's specifically for the athlete and where they're at and what they need.
And yeah, yeah. And I think that's why I kind of take the approach of trying to map out their requirements, because I think otherwise it's just kind of opinion, like you need to have this and it's, this is what I think's right. But it's actually, if they've got a bit of an understanding of the physiology of what's going on, it makes more sense from a performance perspective.
So what I'd love to get your thoughts on is, I'm a big fan of unification, and this is a really important area that is just lacking in the educational journey of our kids. Now, not only in sport, but I mean, there's a great argument that this should be part of their schooling.
Yep.
Makes perfect sense, yep. Right? So where would you start? Like, what would that look like for, you know, a 12-year-old that's identifying with sport, starting to have some success? What do they need to start with in their understanding to fuel appropriately for what they're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm doing a talk tonight for Dio around this, like, for all their, I think we start, like, year 10, is it? I can't remember the years, the youngest. But I think, yeah, it's a challenging one, but just trying to have that awareness of, I think, good basic physiology on the sports nutrition, like, and
yeah,
not getting... I think the biggest challenge is, and it's like what we see in with the GPs, is they're seeing 90% of, you know, is it something like 80% of our adolescents are classified as inactive? So what they're seeing at a school level is not what I'm seeing in my clinic.
Yeah,
we understand that.
Either ends of the spectrum,
yeah,
isn't
yeah.
it?
But it is having that awareness that there's going to be about 20% of students, maybe more in some of these schools, that are highly active and that are going to benefit from more energy. And it's not having everyone on a low sugar, low carbohydrate, low fat diet. It's going,
yeah,
okay, this is...
But you seem like you're an advocate for the science. And
yep,
and that's the magic lies in being able to pitch that appropriately for a 12, 13, 14-year-old, isn't it?
Yeah.
For them to understand, one, what it is that we're talking about, and two, that it relates to them.
Yep, relates to performance. I think that's what I try to, yeah, relate it to performance, and also, obviously, health with, you know, with our RED-S patients in particular, but also, you know, everyone, like, well-being, you know, there's huge links with depression. And I think nutrition, having a good attitude around nutrition and how coaches identify with nutrition is a huge part of, like, it's a really important part of wellness and how we link together socially rather than just thinking of it as fuel. So yeah, and I think that's part of the battle we've seen with fad diets, is there's this group that we know, a large group of our population, but it's these polarizing views, I think, that yeah, get pretty challenging in our space.
Yeah, I mean, pushing back against those things is challenging. I had a conversation with a strength and conditioning coach who works in a school just the other night, and he's struggling with losing his boys at sort of the age of 15.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd much rather go down to Jets and train there.
Yep.
Inside a social environment that is arguably more set up to give them the status that they're,
yeah,
that they're searching for,
yeah,
than the strength and conditioning gym at the school.
Yep.
So yeah, there's these societal forces that are pulling people into,
yep,
into following the fad
and
diets, that,
especially from our perspective, like with social media, TikTok, it's around, there'll be some really good messages out there, but you know, it's mainly around physique. And for physique sure. and performance can be two different things, especially at adolescent age.
So I mean, the entire fitness industry is set up
yep.
around how we look in the mirror, isn't
yep.
it?
Yep.
Which is, and it's such a strong influence when you scroll yep. through your social media feed.
Yeah, I mean, we even found that in our cheese plate. This is 2017, so 5-6 years ago now, that those that had a higher, I guess, correlation with body image had reduced energy intake. And so even back then, before TikTok and Instagram was really going crazy, like, there's, you know, people that you don't think of, like your rugby player, and if you then go to your female athlete, just how much pressure they're under.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea, and I mean, just come to mind, right? Like, so there is a bit of a push to make sport more social, particularly at the adolescent stage of development. But when we play for social reasons, I'm just curious as to whether we get caught into more of the social pressures that come into play, right? When we're there with our mates and it's about being social,
yeah,
then all of a sudden, are we also more predisposed to fitting in with the tribe, like, and
yeah.
looking the way that we're supposed to look? And
yep.
when we lose that performance element, like, or when we lose that this environment that's set up to actually make us better at the sport, where we yep. can link nutrition back into nutrition, like, what do you hang your hat on? Like, is it health? Is that where we need to go with the conversation? Does that
yeah,
make sense?
Yeah, I guess, because what we've seen in our research with Whisper at HBSNZ and our just our recent survey stuff has been that so much of the information comes from teammates, like health information.
Yeah, and there's lots
it's
of
quite concerning.
A lot of the supplement research is like,
yep.
that's it's all driven it's, from
yep.
teammates, isn't
yep.
it?
Yeah, what they're having, and yeah, that's what's got a lot of people in trouble with contamination. So it's yeah, and it's trying to have that bigger presence, but like you said, that's not a people. You can have that presence, but people aren't tuning in. It's not cool. So maybe yeah, it starts at the schools, but I think it's such an uphill battle, because at their fingertips, they're just getting information all day, every day. So you hope that if you're in that sporting environment, you can have good people that are giving good messages. And I think in the female space now, I think a lot of the work Stacey Sims done has been awesome around just that awareness. Like, I've never seen someone that's had so much impact in changing people's perception around like female physiology, and actually strong fueled is better. And so, yeah, maybe more of that. But yeah, it often just comes down to a celebrity that's gone on a diet. You know, like, look at me, I've done this.
Yeah.
I ran a 4-hour marathon without carbohydrates. It's like,
totally,
who
yeah.
really cares?
Yeah, that's been cool watching her journey and the advocacy and the tribe that she's built.
Yeah.
You know, there's very much a need to belong coming from all of us as humans. And we just need to shift what we're belonging to.
Yep.
Do you think about the influence that fame, sporting celebrity status can bring to nutrition? Like, if you
yeah,
I know
yeah.
and I talked I had Kylie Cox just on the podcast in the last episode, and she talked to this idea of, well, there are elite athletes that are struggling in this space, you know, more than you probably know. But have you used that idea of athletes that have got it right going into adolescent spaces and
yeah
pulling on that need to
I think definitely the athlete is the strongest voice by far. So it's, I mean, we've been trying to do this with Whisper, even though it's been kind of halted a bit with COVID and HBSNZ, but having the athlete voice front and center. So we've had, through Waikato University, we've had female athlete conferences where we've had the female voice front and center, and those are the strongest sessions, giving their story, going through it, what's happened. Just yeah, there's lots of athletes, especially in the Reddit space now, that are sharing their story. So that's, I think that's the most powerful. People can relate to that, but it can go the other way as well. So nutrition, it's like, you know, everyone's ultimately trying to sell a book or sell a product, and that can come at the expense of science and polarizing views. So books aren't peer reviewed; they're just someone's opinion. So that's a challenging space as well, and people will. We're pretty adaptable human beings. We can succeed in a multiple array of different sort of feeding strategies. So, yeah, what's right for someone isn't necessarily the best practice.
Yeah, cool. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, how how humans are set up and how, yeah. how we what pulls us in. And from a performance point of view, I was just thinking, there must be an opportunity in it, you know, like, and we do talk to this idea of it's all got a little bit too serious and it's all a little bit too much performance orientated. But there must be an opportunity for coaches out there that are in a space where people are showing up because they're interested in the outcomes to get a real benefit from spending some time around nutrition.
Yep.
Because it doesn't, we're not talking to it much, are we?
No.
In general, like it's not showing up anywhere near as much as it could.
Yep. Yeah, it is hard because it will often say like a school might invest in a strength and conditioner. And then that person might then have to have the duty of delivering the nutrition messages. Some will be good at it. Some won't be up to date, or some might, everyone eats, so they'll just give what's worked for them. And yeah, that's where it can, and it's just the nature of like the funding, I guess. Like,
for sure.
You know, but it is how the system it is something we've always, you know, and I think the good thing in Australia, like I'm part of the Sports Dietitians Australia, they've got really good advocacy where they've got a really good voice, they've got good information, and people know where to kind of access information in New Zealand. We don't have that, unfortunately. So it's a
so what challenge. Is it that what they've got that's working? Can you give me a little bit of
So there's it's been sort of since the early 90s a group of sports dietitians over there. So it's Sports Dietitians Australia. So basically, if you want to work in any sort of sport, a lot of the clubs, like the professional leagues, you have to have a dietitian. Part of, some people will get around it by, they might just have the dietitian, they have a half a day doing supplements, doing that, and then they've got someone else on the side. But it's pretty well recognized now that they need to be accredited, and there's a high level of education that goes on. And so that's been, they've really pushed that well, and they've just got a bigger population. And the difference over there is that most, like pretty much 95%, I think, of anytime you do a nutrition degree, you get a master's, you graduate as a dietitian. Where here we can have multiple pathways of being a dietitian, or you could have a master's in nutrition, still really well educated, but there's a, like a bit of a mismatch. But you do also, you've got a nutritionist that could, you know, you could be a nutritionist. So that's the kind of struggle a little bit as well.
I could just put the label on the end of my name.
Yep. You wouldn't be able to call yourself a registered nutritionist, but probably not anyone realizes what that is.
Right.
We're dietitian, at least it's a clinical certification that's governed, and you know, things like that. So, but Sports Dietitians Australia, that's what it's awesome. So they're just like-minded people that performance focus sport, and I think they've got the balance right. But they have their challenges too, like it's same thing that we see here, but just constantly needing to put nutrition like a bit more in the focus.
Yeah, it's cool though, and I think I always think about one of the most important jobs for adults in the world of adolescent sport is to act as really good filters.
Yep.
So it's not to stand up the front and tell kids what to do, because we know that doesn't usually work very well.
Yep.
And it doesn't develop resilient, adaptable humans. But there definitely is an important role that we play in filtering some of the knowledge that comes through. And so I think there's enough curious kids out there. But as you say, like, where do we send them?
Yep.
You know, where do they go where they can, they can have some autonomy, but not necessarily be free range in what they choose.
I think, and that's what, like, it would be nice if we led the way in that, but we just haven't. Like, I think Australian Institute of Sport have done a great job in nutrition. Like, if you look at their supplement framework, like, I use that on all my information. Athletes, parents can go and download athlete-friendly information sheets on supplements, sports foods, what is the latest research, how does this work in my sport, to SDA website where there's just truckloads of information. So it's like,
is that for kids as well, or is it more HP orientated?
No, it's kind of, they do both. So they do like an athlete friendly information sheet, and then like a practitioner base, which is more like two or three pages more technical. They've just done a great bit of information on female health, where they've got really nice interactive videos around what is a regular menstrual cycle, all these things around female health, really interactive ways to learn. That's free access for everywhere around the world.
Oh, that's cool. We'll drop a link in the show notes for
that. Unfortunately, we were pushing pretty hard to do that with Whisper, which is a group I work with for high performance sport, but unfortunately the powers that be didn't fund us for it, and they kind of beat us to it, but we're hoping that we can get a bit of funding in the near future.
Yeah, I think there's always a need to contextualize it as well. Necessarily have to send them to another country.
Yeah.
It's nice to be able to have something at home.
Yeah.
Just to kind of root it in our own whakapapa and idos like that I think are really powerful.
Yeah.
Dane, I've got a few questions for you as we start to ramp this one down. Is there anything that you've changed your mind on in the last 3, 4, 5 years that's, you know, significantly changed the way you do things?
No, I guess that probably I'm a bit more unique because I just see more and more patients in my area that I see every day. But I guess as you get a bit older as a practitioner, you just get a bit more measured and you've seen things come and go and you don't get as emotional when you see something that's not good science or that's getting... I find I can't look at a lot of social media because I get too frustrated with, you know, the messages that are getting pushed. But I guess just trying to... I think I'm pretty in a good place with, like, nothing's changing. It's just I think there's more and more messages now around the right way to do things with science. I think ultimately, if you polarize yourself, it's going to come back to get you because the science will eventually, you know. So we see a lot of that in nutrition. And people can make a name for themselves of being on the other side of a polarizing message.
Yeah, so and isn't it hard too when you buy into something? And I've been guilty of this before. You buy into something and all of a sudden, if you're curious enough, you actually read something that tells a completely opposite story.
Yeah.
And then you're just confused.
Yep. And I think that's what we try to do. Like, it's been awesome over the years with the Chiefs and the Blues and Sevens, actually trying to do our own research and finding like a supplement or a way of doing things and going, okay, having a really open mind and go, okay, well, let's look at this deeper. So we're doing research at the moment on continuous blood glucose monitors in our patients. So that's a new part of technology that's just the next year, it's just going to go through the roof. But
yeah, that's interesting. I know there's a bit of science around longevity using those.
Yeah.
But it's in the sport domain, is that relatively new, is it?
Yeah. So like the idea is that you could maybe use it as a fuel gauge to go, okay, when do I need fuel, like this and that. But what we're learning is it's just a minefield of information that, you know, no one's had this real life information to the second around blood glucose metabolism. So it's trying to decipher what's relevant. So we're kind of looking at it, could it be a valuable educational tool for nutrition rather than just doing a food diary and reviewing someone's diet? Maybe there's some nice bits of information that someone could get an understanding of if their fueling strategy is going well.
Yeah.
Like blood glucose overnight. But there's also the risk of like becoming quite anxious and overlooking the data.
So, it's like sleep tracking is a little bit like that too, isn't it? Particularly for the A types.
Yep.
You give them that too and all of a sudden they're monitoring their sleep to the last, you know, to the nth degree.
Yeah, so that's something that like we just wanted to be on the front foot and we had the opportunity to do research in it. So it's like we're kind of spending the next 2 or 3 years looking at it. And I think that's the kind of mindset. There's some things you see in nutrition which just does, the physiology just doesn't match up. And I guess I'm around enough good sports scientists or trainers to just have these conversations and like, yeah.
I love the idea though of having these technological tools that allow you to do like these N=1 experiments.
Yep.
And not necessarily to get to robust science, but to help people just be more scientific in the way they approach their lives.
Yep.
You know, through the scientific process, just a way of thinking.
Yep.
Well, I'm going to try this and I'm going to see how it affects me and then I'm going to make an informed decision based on whether I keep it or throw it out.
Yep. Yep.
That's a pretty cool way. And it matches the science of learning too, if we can do this. Ultimately, I think you need kids to engage in learning nutrition.
Yep.
As opposed to it to be, here's your program, just follow it.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the challenging part is the psychological element, and so much of this, especially of those young athletes, is the balance. It can be a good thing, it could be a bad thing, like tracking steps. You know, some people, simply tracking steps can make things really hard for some people. So, yeah, it's just probably having that understanding. That's what we're kind of, the analogy they're kind of using for like glucose monitoring is like the first heart rate monitors. It's like, well, what is 185 meters? Is that good or bad?
There's a massive evolution to go through, isn't it?
And, yeah.
So those early adopters are probably going to be the ones that miss out Or at least it's not going to go so well.
Yeah.
Because we don't really know what we're doing.
We don't really know what it means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like from a nutritional context point of view, how does the idea of balance shape up in your head? In general, what does balance mean to you, either as a practitioner or looking from above into the youth sports space?
Yeah, I think it's like most people when I worked in elite sports say, oh, does every athlete follow a plan? It's like, no, they just don't have the understanding that, I mean, my plans are trying to give a structure, and the idea would be like in a couple of weeks, it's just second nature. It's understanding when you need a bit of fuel, when you don't, how much, get an understanding of that. But yeah, I think, yeah, just trying to create a good positive mindset around nutrition and not being restrictive, not labeling foods good or bad. That's a real bugbear of mine, or this food's high in sugar. But yeah, well, it could be part of your overall diet that, you know, 20, like looking at diet as a whole, like over a day, over a week, not just labeling foods. This food might help with that. It's just, yeah. And that's what I think comes from the media. So just having that, trying to create a good relationship with food. It starts, I think, with the parents. Just good, you know, good relationships. And that's the key thing for young athletes, is just getting them through this challenging time with a good mindset. I think that if we come away with that and they're fueled enough and they're training well, that's kind of our goal.
Yeah, there's this interesting idea that's coming through in a lot of the stuff that I've been following, reading, listening to, of wayfinding. And it's sort of it's an idea around learning and a pedagogical approach to helping people to pick up new ideas. And I mentioned this in the last episode, but a guy talked to this idea showing up and when a father took his son fishing.
Yeah, and I'm a keen fisherman.
Yeah, I read that. And the way that the child learns to fish is not by being taught. It's just being in an environment with someone who can fish. And there's a lot to be said, I think, for nutrition in that sense, is being in an environment with people that make good decisions and understand enough of good food.
Yep.
To set the environment that kids just absorb over time.
Yep.
And you mentioned the importance of parents. And again, it's like, it's hard to keep throwing more and more things in the laps of parents, but environments are powerful.
Yeah, I think if anything, just like overfeed them, if anything. Like just don't restrict. Just like their body will turn into what it needs to be. As long as you're well prepared, you're doing most of the stuff from home, just, yeah, not using food as a reward or, you know, like all those mental cues that can cause a restriction and labeling foods good or bad. I think
it's good advice because there's a lot of that's going on, and through, you know, well-intentioned adults,
yeah,
you know, what, not wanting to put too much sugar, as you mentioned earlier, in front of their kids,
yeah,
you know, not wanting them to eat too much fried food, you know, in the forms of takeaways or these types of things. But as you say, constriction often causes problems, doesn't it, down the line?
Yeah, and I think it's just being conscious of, because there will be a lot of parents that are going on their own journey with weight loss or improving lifestyle, and you want to do that as a family, but it's only in that situation, if you have a really active adolescent, you just need to kind of consider that, because sometimes it does unravel a bit. We do see, you know, not enough carbohydrate, not enough glycogen, fatigue kicking in, like it's just, or fasting. Like I've had a few patients where all of a sudden they're not eating until midday for a 15-year-old rower, and then that's just, and it's all well intentioned. Like I think it's all, you know, they've read the information and they thought they're doing the right thing, but it's, yeah, probably just if we can just have more awareness around that, I think would be positive.
Cool. All right, last question, and this is the one question I ask everybody at the end of the pod. What is youth sport for, from your point of view, Dane?
Oh, I think having got a 6 and 7-year-old, I think one of the best things of sport is, I just want my kids to just be challenged, I guess, and just be healthy, but learn to fail in a safe environment. That's what I've kind of, the more I've read around that as well, is like, you know, not helicoptering them, but putting them through situations which are challenging that they can learn to get through. And I think that sets them up well for life. And I think the other big thing is having a community and having friendships and also having experiences that they, you know, go through with their mates or whether it's by themselves, it just challenge them. rather than going through life without that. And then, you know, you hear these stories of when they are confronted with challenging times that they don't have that resilience. So yeah, building resilience and learning to empty the tank, like Dave Galbraith would talk about. Like, he's talking about if all his kids could do was just learn to empty the tank.
what does he mean
like
by
just
empty
going
the tank?
Out and just letting it rip, basically just running till the tank's empty.
Yeah, and I'd imagine that's both a physical idea and a psychological idea.
Yeah,
is being able to put it out there and not holding anything back because of so many fears that show up.
Yeah, yeah. And then just, yeah, like having respect for competition and sportsmanship. And I think that's really cool, is like my kids do jiu-jitsu. One of them does jiu-jitsu a lot at the moment, and it's cool. Like, they do like live wrestling, and then the first thing they're taught is to get up and shake hands and with the opponent, and it's pretty cool to kind of see that at 7 years old.
They embed that really young in those types of martial art environments, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's interesting though, like you've talked about, it might have been off air, but surfing and these sports that are a little bit more free in the way they're set up, but they've got those two elements you talk to. They've got safety. Like, they have a real sense of belonging. Like surfing, if you're a surfer, then you kind of belong to something, eh?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, they've got massive, I call it everyday risk.
Yeah, I didn't realize it until I kind of stopped surfing when kids and when overseas, was just everyone talks now about having their own wellness, but there's not much more you could do as a surfer, just getting out there for 2.5 hours, just being alone in the water to reset your thoughts, and you kind of take that for granted. Why you used to think it was such an amazing experience is, you kind of get off the grid, basically.
Mm. But there's also those times, you know, like waxing up or getting your weddy on, where there's all the other surfers there and you kind of connecting, and then you go on your own journey to, as you mentioned, to empty the tank.
Yeah.
To put it all out there, and then you get back, and that sense of safety returns on when you're on back on dry land.
Yeah, yeah, and you're achieving something. Sort of like golf, you're constantly getting better and better. You can see those sports that are so hard or challenging, you really can get addicted. Well, I do. Like fishing. Fishing's my last 2 years, really. Addicted to fishing.
what's pulled you in?
I tried to learn. It's probably a good parenting story. During lockdown, I was like, right, I just thought we'd be in lockdown for ages. I thought, right, we'll start learning to fish, take the kids fishing. So I bought all this gear, and then like the next week they said, oh, lockdown's finished. So then we'd go down the wharf, like we'd go down to Omaha a little bit, and up to Omaha, I should say. And then I just started getting more and more like the competitiveness in me. And then next thing, within about 3 months, there's a couple of mates I know that are looking to buy a boat. We bought a boat, now we're fishing, and now we're catching kingfish, and we're going after big fish. It all happened pretty quick. And then so the kids go up, we take kids out fishing, or just catching, you know, we're out by a little barrier around there, and it's just amazing. Sort of like surfing, you're just out in nature, you're just seeing whales, dolphins, and just and again, but it's coming down to that curious nature of there's just so many ways you can fish, and having friends that are really good at fishing teaching me techniques of more modern fishing, you know, like soft baiting, lures, all of these types of fishing. So, you know, like not using bait and all this kind of stuff that you're like, is there such a learning curve? But you're doing it in Mother Nature, and you've got your kids, and so that's been a real, that's like, my kids now are obsessed with fishing. That's what I think
about. it sounds like we should go for a fish, and I'll bring my kids along too. They love it. They love it as well.
Yeah.
We've done a little bit of fly fishing with a good mate, and they're just addicted to that. We can get out, which is not anywhere near enough.
There's something about once they start catching big fish, there's kind of no going back, basically, with kids.
Super cool. Dayton, is there anything else that you'd like to share?
No, just thanks for having me. It's been good.
Kia ora.
Yeah.